Good morning, everyone. On this wonderful Sunday, where we dedicate our thinking, our prayers, and our hopes to the vision of our beloved alumnus, Martin Luther King Jr., to Dean and Jan Hill, to those who are in Radio Land, God bless you, and may we hear again anew the words of an old Negro spiritual, plenty good room, plenty good room, plenty good room in my Father's kingdom, plenty good room, plenty good room. Just choose your seat and sit down. I'm dedicating this King's Day sermon to Amy Dufree West, one of my doctoral students who is now in hospice. Her life is dedicated to this vision of plenty good room. In the midst of unspeakable bondage, living in a world that was too crowded to grant them rights to full humanity and the dignity of citizenship, these black and unknown bards envision a world where there was plenty good room. When these unlettered biblical exegetes and creative theologians overheard scriptures like John 14, which was read in your hearing, or other stories about heaven and a world beyond time and history, they perceived more than a Jesus who would return to prepare a place for them elsewhere. Rather, they signified on and imaginatively reconstructed the very concept of heaven as a place of plenty good room. They believed that there was plenty good room in the present because the God whom they served was not captive to time prescribed by their masters, a time of commodification and incarceration of black bodies. The words of this old song speaks volumes to where we are as a nation on this very special Sunday. And it calls us all to remember, retell, and relive its story in this strange period of American history that is returning to a time that we thought we had bypassed. We're witnessing a reversal of time that I sometimes call American post-racism, a return to the language of America first and let's make America great again. A reconfiguration of time and history that harkens back to our ugly past where black, brown, and poor people in this country were assigned seats in the overcrowded house that race built. But my ancestors refused to believe there was not enough room for them in the United States of America. And so they chose their seats and sat down in spite of the indignities hurled against them. What a word this is for us as we commemorate the life, legacy, and assassination of one of our greatest prophets, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Like the witnesses in this song, we too need to return to this old spiritual and ask whether there's room enough for the poor, disenfranchised, and hopeless in America's future. During a time in which we're hearing our president disparage African nations as holes for defecation, holes that we help dig and may fall into, as we hear him deride our neighbors, El Salvador, Haiti, and Mexico, as we are witnessing huge tax cuts for the wealthy, the dismantling of health care, the building of walls to keep others out, the outright attacks on fragile natural environments, the strengthening of an insane and insidious prison industrial complex, saber rattling with North Korea, and the fomenting of visceral emotions unleashed after the tragic display of domestic terrorism in Charlottesville, Virginia. I want to remind you this morning, nonetheless, there's indeed plenty good room in our nation for a diverse and inclusive society, or what the late historian John Hope Franklin called the land of room enough. But first, we must create space for others in our precious but precarious experiment in democracy. We must create and share democratic space. As one commentator remarked, democratic space is an unwritten permission to think, a fundamental consideration and respect granted by a state to its subjects to raise a voice of dissent and to disagree. It is this democratic space which forms the basis of a vibrant, healthy democracy. Sharing space with others with whom we have become accustomed is not hard. But to work to share space with those who appear as strangers, those whom we strongly disagree or who frighten us in their otherness, is difficult and dangerous. Democracy at its best for Martin Luther King Jr. was a squabble, a contentious exchange of ideas, opinions, values, and practices within the context of civil relations. When we forget this important truth, my brothers and sisters, we create conditions of alienation and violence. However we feel about building walls to keep others out, our greatest challenge is not keeping others out of this country. But as King thought, we must develop new and better ways of seeing and responding to our own interrelatedness and interconnectedness, not only in the United States of America, but in the world. Martin Luther King Jr.'s perspective on the civil rights movement was always global. From that first speech at Holt Street Baptist Church in Montgomery, through his latter years, his statements about our connectedness with neighbors around the globe became even more pronounced. King believed that first there would need to be a reckoning with Western imperialism's own presuppositions about power. Before his tragic death in 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. reminded this nation that we no longer live in a small house, but rather we have inherited a world house. He suggested in clear and strident language that we must learn to live together as brothers and sisters or die apart as fools. I wish the White House could hear that this morning. During his latter years, King was acutely aware of the need for a broader interpretive framework, which he called a worldwide perspective, for understanding what he perceived as a crucial passage in our history. He suggested that the struggles of African Americans must be understood in light of a shifting of the West's basic outlooks and philosophical presuppositions about power. He said, "We have inherited a large house, a great world house, in which we have to live together, black and white, Easterner and Westerner, Gentile and Jew, Catholic and Protestant, Muslim and Hindu, a family unduly separated in ideas, culture, and interests, who, because we can never again live apart, must learn somehow to live together with each other in peace." But as we sit in this sanctuary on this Sunday dedicated to his memory, that democratic space is being contested by the present administration and many cowardly colleagues who display a non-action in the Republican Congress. I would like to share a personal story that helps illustrate this contestation of democratic space. It was an encounter about 5 years ago in a crowded parking lot at the corner of West Paces Ferry and Northside Parkway in Atlanta. Those of you who are familiar with Atlanta might know this is a very elite area. I was searching for a parking space. I was in a hurry to meet my son's future father-in-law. And I'm the real deal when it comes to an absent-minded professor. I often get confused. But I really wanted to be on time as a sign to my new family of the kind of family that they were inheriting. So in my concentration on trying to find a space, I suddenly realized I was driving in the wrong direction in a one-way lane. I was transgressing. When I saw a woman moving towards her car, however, I looked through my rearview window to make sure that no one was behind me and decided to wait in hopes of making an expeditious entry once she departed. As I waited for her, I noticed that a fine-looking white middle-aged gentleman driving a top-down red convertible with a huge shaggy dog in the passenger seat. He was driving in the proper direction, and he entered the same lane. I thought he had stopped to accommodate the other driver's exit. So I reasoned to myself, since I was not obstructing traffic and no one was behind me, that maybe, just maybe, the gentleman in the convertible was extending not only a courtesy to the other driver, but also to me. But after the woman had exited, this fine-looking gentleman in the really cool red convertible rushed into the space, signaling his conquest of disputed territory. Perhaps I'd been living in New England too long and had forgotten my place in the genteel southern culture of Atlanta. So when I nonchalantly questioned him in Boston style, his aggressive conquest of space, and I just simply exclaimed, "Oh, how dare you!" He responded with a racial insult filled with an old venomous tone that left me unsettled, disarmed, and in disbelief. "How black of you!" he shouted back at me with a vitriol that I found disturbing, disproportionate to context. After all, it was just a parking space. He continued to insult me by shouting that the problem in this country is that Obama and the rest of you think that you can just take over everything. By the way, this was August 31, 2012, a day I shall always remember. During the height of the presidency of Barack Obama's second campaign, I was unaware that I, nor Obama, nor the millions of people who voted for him really wanted to take this country from anyone. On that very special day, I just wanted to find a parking space and to meet with my son's future father-in-law. I'll spare you the exchange that we shared after that. Our challenge, my friends, is to create, to enlarge democratic space. 5 years after the end of President Obama's two-term presidency and 1 year after the election of Donald J. Trump, I think there's a deep and profound issue that threatens the very future of our republic and democracy: contested democratic space. During the spring of 2006, I traveled throughout South Africa lecturing on ethical leadership for the State Department. One of my visitations was in Durban. My host took me to Pietermaritzburg, the township famous for an incident early in the career of Mahatma Gandhi. In 1893, Gandhi arrived in Durban to serve as legal counsel to the merchant Dada Abdullah. Early in his employment, he was asked by Abdullah to take a trip to Pretoria. Traveling by train, Gandhi acquired a first-class ticket and had proceeded to his compartment when a railway official requested that he remove himself to the van compartment, since coolies and non-whites were not permitted to sit in first-class seats. When Gandhi protested and refused to comply, he was thrown violently off the train and his luggage tossed onto the platform. I remember speaking with Gandhi's granddaughter about this, and she said Gandhi stayed at the Peter Maritzburg station all night that night in the cold of that winter night and began to reflect on his duty. Should he stay and fight for his rights or return to India? We know now that he stayed and chose a seat in the heart of South African politics and returned later to India, where he challenged the hegemony of the great British Empire. And the world has never been the same since. As I stood in that train station, which now has a memorial dedicated to his courageous action after the incident, I reflected on a similar incident that involved an African-American seamstress named Rosa Parks, who also had been told to give up her seat to a white passenger. But Rosa Parks, in a defiant act of courage, chose her seat and sat down. And when she sat down, Martin Luther King Jr. stood up. On February the 1st, 1964, young black men, Joseph McNeil, Franklin McCain, Ezell Blair Jr., and David Richmond, students at North Carolina A&T State University, despite the segregated statutes prohibiting black people to eat in the downtown Woolworth store, decided there was plenty good room, and they chose their seats and sat down. They were denied service, but that did not stop them. They sat in their seats until the store closed and returned the next day with 16 more students. That didn't stop them. They stayed there until the store was closed. And on that third day, there were 60 students. And by the fourth day, over 300 people chose their seats and sat down. Their courageous action gained momentum and sit-ins spread throughout the South, and the Greensboro Four, as they came to be called, were a catalyst for the formation of SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which changed the course of the civil rights movement. My friends, as I close, the struggle for plenty good room requires revolutionary patience, irrepressible hope, and an insatiable desire to be free. King's vision of freedom and equality was not a solo act. Rather, it arose out of the solidarity of men and women, young people and elders from every color and creed, who decided to choose their seats and sit down. King is a product of a rich and vibrant tradition of protest. King's vision of the beloved community and the World House grows out of this context of struggle, choosing a seat and sitting down. Long before King was catapulted into national and international fame after the Montgomery bus boycott, long before he stood before the Lincoln Memorial and declared to a pilgrimage of thousands that America had written its citizens of color a bad check that had come back marked insufficient funds, long before his campaigns for open public accommodations and voting rights, long before his outspoken stance on an unjust war in Vietnam, his dream of plenty good room, born in the violent context of the Deep South, where the inseparable twins of white racism and economic injustice had relegated black people to the status of things, non-persons, without names and destinies. The dream of community, was already alive in the hearts of those who are willing to take seats and sit down. Yes, my friends, before the moronic diatribes and tweets of Donald J. Trump, Martin Luther King Jr. sought to make America great. But his was not through the demeaning and despicable attacks that we're hearing from our current president. And I hope he's only current. King believed that there wasn't room enough for other voices, other beliefs and opinions that narrow, myopic proposal of making America great again signals to all of us. In his famous I Have a Dream speech, King offered this conditional challenge to his fellow citizens. And if America is to be a great nation, if America is to be a great nation, not great again, but if it is to become a great nation, we must let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, from the mighty mountains of New York, from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, from the curvaceous slopes of California, from Stone Mountain of Georgia, from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee, from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside, he said, let freedom ring. My friends, as we leave today, we must be willing to let freedom ring. We must be willing to choose our seats and sit down. We must be willing to do justice, love, mercy, and walk humbly before God. The vision of the World House is not a dream for cravens and cowards who hide behind false justifications for non-action. It is not for spectators who stand on the sidelines and watch injustice and exploitation at a distance. It is not for superficial optimists who bury their heads in the sand like the proverbial ostrich and pretend that everything will be all right anyway. For when we bury our heads in the sand, we always leave more exposed than is hidden. It is not for greedy and insane puppeteers who hide behind the curtains of social fiction and manipulate the mindscape. It is not for sentimentalists and pop patriots and vain practitioners of an American civil religion, sometimes called white evangelicals, who wave the flag higher than they wave the cross. It is a dream for those who are willing to join the ranks of men and women who are so inspired by the moral order of the universe and the sacredness of human personality that they are willing to make a track to the water's edge and lay their bodies down as a bridge for others. It is a dream for men and women who are willing to stand alone when the crowds disperse, who will keep on moving against the odds, who will refuse to cling to falsehoods and lies that contradict reality, who believe that the truth has the final word in this universe and that justice and love will endure forever. This is the vision of Martin Luther King Jr., a dream born out of the zeal for justice, nurtured in the praxis of struggle, refined in the fires of persecution, strengthened by the arms of faith, propelled by the vision of hope, enriched by the power of love, and set free by the truth that no lie can endure forever. We are his heirs. We are the ones to whom he has passed the torch. We are the dreamers who must make this world a better place. Dream on, dreamers, here in Marsh Chapel and elsewhere. Dream in season and out of season. Dream in the valley and climb to the mountain with King and see the land of room enough. See a new house, a world house with plenty good room. Choose your seat and sit down. And those who love God and peace and justice said, Amen.